Okay, good afternoon, everybody. This is Monday, May 4th. We're in the respiratory chapter. And let's see, how far did we get along last time? Oh, we didn't even begin this particular chapter. Oh, that's right. Okay, it's coming back to me. Okay, well, let's start at the beginning. Oh, yeah, we had to talk about MRIs last time. All right, I got to turn this light down a little bit so I can see. Okay, so chapter 16, this is. All right, and I didn't put the notes up yet on Blackboard because I'm still working on the lecture, so thanks for coming. I'll give it a dry run on you guys and see if I like it or not. But anyway, one thing I did get on Blackboard for you was the study guide for chapter 14. That is probably more important, so you can download that, start reviewing some questions and exam figures for the test, which for you guys is a week from Wednesday. Okay, it's a week from Wednesday. So you got to pay attention as to what chapters are going to be on there. So it's going to be 14, 16, maybe 17. If that's digestion or urinary system, one or the other, maybe both. Okay, so respiration, I'm not going to start the slideshow because I want to flip back and forth between a couple of different programs. It's related to three main functions in our body. The first is ventilation of gas, just moving air in and out of our lungs. Gas exchange in two places, gas exchange between air in the alveoli and the capillaries in your lungs. So the reason why gas moves is because of a concentration gradient. So which way is oxygen going to move? In terms of high concentration to?
From high to low.
Yeah, to low concentration. Okay. And the way that we talk about concentration of particles in the gas is by the partial pressure. So if the partial pressure increases, the concentration increases. So we measure the pressure of these various compounds. So it's going to go from high partial pressure to low partial pressure. Okay, so that's gas exchange in the lungs, but we're also interested in gas exchange in the tissues. And again, gases are going to move from high to low partial pressure, even though they're going to be dissolved in fluid. And then the third thing is utilization. And that's a metabolic respiration. And we spent months, maybe not months, but weeks looking at respiration, cellular respiration. What's the bottom line for cellular respiration? To produce ATP, right? So, I mean, you got CO2 being produced. Where is CO2 produced, by the way? What metabolic pathway? Krebs cycle, exactly. And where is oxygen utilized? At the very end of the electron transport chain. Perfect, all right? So we call that respiration too, but as you can imagine, that's a lot different than ventilating, moving air in and out of your lungs, and gas exchange due to changes in partial pressure. So all three of these things we consider respiration. Okay, O2, utilization of tissue, sometimes we call that internal respiration, which is different than, of course, ventilation. All right, and here's something important to know. Gas exchange is passive and occurs only by diffusion. So things, molecules will move from high to low. So if oxygen is moving, which way is oxygen moving? From the air into your body or from your body into the air? Air into your body, so where is it got to be high concentration?
Outside,
and it's low concentration inside your body, so it diffuses in. That's the only way that it's going to move. Carbon dioxide is the opposite. Where is carbon dioxide the highest? In your tissues or in the air? In your tissues. Otherwise, it wouldn't leave your body and go into the air. As a matter of fact, carbon dioxide concentration there is pretty close to zero, so there's a big concentration gradient removing CO2 from your body. Okay. All right, so respiratory structures, some of these you should be aware of from anatomy, but the structural and functional unit of exchange in the respiratory system is this little thing right here. That's an alveolus, right? And this is an alveolar sac. You have about 300 million alveoli that make up your lungs, and it is specialized to allow for exchange. So we could take an alveolus and peel it like an apple or an orange and lay the skin down of that alveolus on a table, right? And we could take all 300 million of them and lay them flat next to each other. How big would that table have to be in order to take all 300 million? And that would describe the surface area for exchange in the lung. All right, I'm not sure anybody really knows, but, well, I know. That's why I'm asking you. It's okay to ask a question if you know the answer. It is 70 square meters. So what is 70 square meters? That's half of a tennis court. All right, so that's the surface area. So that's huge. And so through evolution, that surface area has figured out how to wait to fold it up and stick it inside your thoracic cavity, which is really good because I can't imagine why I would like to be as wide as half as a tennis court and half as tall. All right, so that's really handy. So when I say surface area, what's the everyday language that you should think of? What does that really mean? The surface area for exchange is really and I should have run this by you last time before we left because it was easy to do. But here I can take, this looks like, what kind of device is this? It's a meter stick. Yeah, so it's measuring distance. So I could measure the surface area of this door right here. What's the surface area of this door? Yeah, it's length times width. So the width is, oh, look at that, perfect. 1 meter, okay, so that's nice. And what's the length? It's 1 meter. Okay, times exactly 2 meters. Okay, so what's the surface area of that doorway right there? It's 1 times 2 or 2 square meters. All right, so if you've got that doorway, just a pedestrian door, how many people can get through that doorway at one time? Maybe 2, 3, something like that. Okay, 2.5 at one time. So that describes the exchange. So 2 square meters, about 2.5 people can get through at a time. But now instead of a pedestrian door, say it's a garage door, which is going to be instead of 1 meter, let's say it is maybe 7 or 8 meters wide by 3 meters tall. How many people can get through that doorway at one time? Oh, I don't know, maybe 30, maybe 40 people at one time. So as the surface area for exchange goes up, as the surface area goes up, what happens to exchange? It goes way up, right? Okay. So that's why we have 70 square meters as a surface area inside our lungs to enhance exchange of what, carbon dioxide and oxygen from the air and alveolus into the blood. Okay? So when I say surface area, what should you really be thinking of in everyday language?
Exchange.
Possibility of exchange. But just not even a scientific way of thinking, you should think of a surface area as a doorway. Okay, just think of surface area as a doorway for exchange, like you said. Okay, and it's the shape of the alveolus that maximizes that exchange. All right, now what you don't see on this slide, on this alveolus right here is a capillary network. It's a mesh of capillaries that surrounds the alveolus. Plus there's something else. There's another mesh. There's another network that surrounds that alveolus. And that, in your anatomy book, it shows it very nicely, is a network of elastic fibers. So what can you tell me about elastic fibers? When they stretch, what do they do when you release that tension?
Recoil.
It recoils. It pulls the alveolus back to its original shape. And as a matter of fact, these elastic fibers might even shrink an alveolus down to nothing, might cause it to collapse. But we're going to see something that prevents it from collapsing completely. All right, so that's going to be important. All right, so here if we look at a cross-section of an alveolus right here, we see that the kind of cell that makes up the epithelium of the alveolus is what kind? Is it stratified or simple?
Simple.
It's simple, just one layer. And is it cuboidal or columnar or squamous?
Squamous.
It's squamous. It's flat. So a simple squamous epithelium is specialized for specifically exchange. It's a thin membrane to allow things to move across. So that's what we call an alveolar type 1 cell that makes up the alveolus. There's an alveolar type 2 cell right here, and its job is to secrete a chemical, right, that is coating the alveolus right here. And that chemical is called surfactant. Okay, because water, and you know this from a physiology class, what can you tell me about water? Is it slippery or is it sticky? It is. I hear a range of responses. It is really sticky. Because why? Because it's loaded with hydrogen bonds that produces surface tension. So if we have water on this side of an alveolus and water on this side over here, right, if these two walls were ever to touch each other, they would never release each other. They'd be stuck together. And next time I'll bring in, if I can remember, an experiment to prove that to you. But at home, go home and take a couple plates that fit together really nice, okay, put them down on the table, and then just grab the top one. If they're dry, can you lift the top one right off? Absolutely, no problem. But now put a little film of water between the plates and lift the top one, what's going to happen? The bottom one's going to stick to it. Okay? The same thing would happen to an alveolus if there was no surfactant. The walls would stick together and then you couldn't breathe, and then, of course, we would all be really miserable. You'd turn blue and all kinds of nasty things. All right, so the alveolar type 2 cell here defeats surface tension so that the alveolus can expand. That's the job. And these type 2 cells mature late in gestation, and as a matter of fact, they don't really start secreting surfactant until the fetus experiences stress, and that's really what initiates parturition. So if somebody is born prematurely and by cesarean section, then these type 2 cells don't mature and secrete surfactant, and what is one of the problems of a prematurely delivered baby? Okay, their lungs aren't developed in the sense that they're not secreting surfactant, their alveoli don't expand. So they're in respiratory distress, and the best way we know to handle that is to put them in oxygen, into an oxygen tent. All right, so that's how we support them. All right, so that's the job of surfactant and this alveolar type 2 cell. Okay, so there is a concept of the respiratory membrane. The respiratory membrane is the membrane that oxygen has to move across from the alveolus into the capillary, or conversely, CO2 from the capillary into the alveolus. So what are the parts that, the components that a molecule has to diffuse across? Okay, and your book does an okay job with that, but I add a little component to it, because right on the surface of the endothelium right here of an alveolus is what? That layer of surfactants. So that's the first thing I would like for you to know. Right? What makes up the respiratory membrane? The first thing is the layer of surfactant. Okay? The next thing that oxygen would have to diffuse across is the wall of the alveolus. Right? The next thing is this interstitial space right here. And the third thing is the wall of the capillary. And in order for diffusion to take place, all of those things should be very, very thin. And indeed it is. So those are the four things that make up the respiratory membrane. Surfactant, wall of the alveolus, interstitial space, and wall of the capillary. And then something truly is inside your body if it diffuses through those different spaces. Okay? Okay. All right, I think I'm not going to go over very much anatomy right here. Just that you should remember that the lungs, the pleural cavity, is not open to the outside world. So it has a membrane surrounding the lungs. What kind of membrane surrounds the lungs if it's a cavity not open to the outside world? It's called a serous membrane. Serous membrane. And can you remember how many different parts are there to a serous membrane? There are three main parts. Okay? There is one part, I don't know if I have a enlarged version of this. I don't have a pointer. But right, so here is a lung. Here's a nice cross-section of a lung. We're not going to pay attention to the heart. But right on the surface of the lung is the first division of the serous membrane, which is what we call the visceral pleural membrane. Okay? And it's probably labeled visceral pleural. I just can't expand this slide. I don't have a pointer. So let me, the up arrow right there, visceral pleural membrane, right on the surface of the lung. And then there's a little space, which we call the pleural cavity, and that's filled with serous fluid, like all serous cavities are filled with. And that fluid is very much like water, which means what? Sticky or not sticky? It is sticky, okay? It's only the surfactant that isn't sticky. And then the third part of the pleural membrane, pleural serous membrane, is the parietal pleura, which is up against the chest wall. All right, so how is it that we ventilate? How is it that we breathe air in and out of our lungs? We change the size of our thoracic cavity. All right, and that change is described by Boyle's Law. Boyle's Law says that pressure is inverse to volume. All right, so that means what? If volume goes up, what happens to pressure? If it's inversely related, it goes down. All right, if pressure goes up, what happens to volume? It decreases, right? Okay. So that is Boyle's Law. So the way that we move gas in and out of our lungs is that we manipulate this pressure right here by changing the volume of our thoracic cavity. So if we're going to decrease the pressure inside of our lungs, what do we need to do to the volume of our lungs?
Expand.
Okay? Yeah, we need to expand, right? Because it's inversely related. All right, because we want the atmospheric pressure is going to stay constant. We need to decrease thoracic pressure in order for air to flow from outside to inside our lungs. We increase the volume and air flows inside of our lungs. So that's what we do. So let's go back to this diagram right here. This just shows that when we expand our ribcage or thoracic cavity, all right, the thorax gets bigger. But now, why do the lungs get bigger? Because this serous fluid right here acts like a glue to glue the surface of the lungs to the thoracic wall, because water is sticky. So as we increase our thoracic volume, that pulls on the surface of the lungs, right? And that helps to expand the lungs. But it also is decreasing the pressure, and so air flows inside of our lungs for both of those reasons, right? So what is resisting that? The thing that is resisting that is the elastic property of all those elastic fibers that we saw around the alveoli. Okay. So, surface tension, I talked about that already, talked about that, surfactant, mechanics of breathing. All right, here's a really good diagram because it shows what muscles are important for inspiration and what muscles might be used for expiration, right? But breathing has two different kinds. There is what we call breathing at rest, and then forced breathing when you are hyperventilating. Quiet breathing is just normal everyday breathing, okay? When you're not exercising, the muscles that you use for quiet breathing are the diaphragm. Notice that the diaphragm is dome-shaped like this. And when it contracts, what happens? It becomes flat, and that increases the volume of the thoracic cavity. What happens to the pressure inside the thorax when the volume increases? Remember, it's inversely related, so the pressure decreases inside the thorax, remains high in the air, so air flows into your lungs as a result. All right, so for quiet breathing, the diaphragm is important, and also maybe the external intercostals are important because the external intercostals, all right, raise the rib cage out and it raises it anteriorly as well. So it increases the volume in both directions. The diaphragm increases the volume inferiorly. The external intercostals increase the volume laterally and anteriorly. And so air flows into your lungs. Now, what about for expiration? When you're breathing quietly, how do you exhale when you're not hyperventilating? You can just relax muscles. For instance, what happens to the diaphragm if it's contracted, right? When it's contracted flat, when it relaxes, what happens? It goes back to that dome shape, decreases the thoracic volume. That increases the pressure inside the chest above atmospheric pressure, and air flows out of your lungs as a result of that. Okay, but what else is happening? What other protein did we look at already? Let's go back to here. Okay, it is those elastic fibers around every alveolus. All right, so when we inhaled, when we contracted the diaphragm and expanded the alveoli, that's at the expense of stretching those elastic fibers, When we relax, what do those elastic fibers do? They recoil and pull down on the alveoli, expelling air as well. All right, so for quiet breathing, exhalation is passive. You just relax, and all the energy that you stored in the elastic properties of the diaphragm and the alveoli then are used to force air out of your lungs. So that's for quiet breathing. All right, now for forced breathing, okay, we use some other muscles. Of course, you use let's just talk about inspiration. You use the diaphragm for inspiration, you use the external intercostals, but you might use some other muscles as well. For instance, like the sternocleidomastoid and the scalenes, because they lift up the first couple ribs and then the external intercostals are attached to them. That expands the rib cage, and maybe even the pectoralis minor muscle can be used to help in inspiration. Okay, so that's for forced breathing. And when you're hyperventilating, you can't just passively relax. That won't move air properly. You need to use some other muscles for forced expiration. And the muscles that you use are all the abdominal muscles, like the rectus abdominis in the front. That's going to compress abdominal contents up into the thoracic cavity, and that's going to force air out of your lungs, as well as the transverse abdominis, internal oblique and external oblique, are going to compress abdominal contents up into the thoracic cavity and aid in expiration. So you got those two kinds of breathing and different muscles that are used in every case. But nonetheless, I think the bottom line is you should appreciate what? Boyle's Law. As the volume of your thoracic cavity increases, the pressure decreases, air flows in. As the volume decreases, that increases the pressure, air flows out. Okay? And you might notice that, for instance, somebody with emphysema who has trouble breathing, they have to use a lot more skeletal muscle to ventilate. And actually, it's kind of easy sometimes to see somebody with emphysema because what can you tell me about the musculature of their thorax? Because they're using it strenuously to breathe all the time, it's hypertrophied. All right, so somebody with emphysema has a typical barrel-chested shape because their muscles are very strong. They need all of those skeletal muscles just to normally ventilate themselves. Okay. So quiet breathing versus deep breathing. And that pleural space is always going to have a negative pressure in it compared to the intrapleural pressure or atmospheric pressure. And that keeps the lungs attached to the thoracic wall. Okay, we call that the intrapleural pressure. So for instance, what's happening here at rest? Neither breathing nor neither inhaling or exhaling. The intrapleural pressure is 756 millimeters of mercury. The intrapulmonary pressure is 760, so the lungs are, all right, being pulled up against the wall of the thorax because the intrapleural pressure is less. All right, and the same for expiration. All right, the pressure inside the lungs goes way up to 760, which is above atmospheric pressure. All right, atmospheric pressure, let's just say, is 769 millimeters of mercury. Okay, all right, but the intrapleural pressure is 757, so again, the lungs are still glued to the wall of the thorax. And then during inspiration, the intrapulmonary pressure is 757, but the intrapleural pressure is 154, very negative. So again, it's still attaching the lungs to the wall of the thorax. So that kind of describes why what happens to somebody when they have a perforation of their thoracic wall. When there's a hole that goes from the outside to the pleural space right here, that will allow air to flow right through that hole into the pleural cavity because it's always what? It's always a negative pressure. So air flows in there, destroys that negative pressure, and then what happens to this lung over here? It collapses. And why does it collapse? What's around every alveolus? That, all those elastic fibers, right? And so when that glue between the surface of the lung and the surface of the inside surface of the thoracic cage is destroyed, right? Air just flows in there and the lung collapses just because of all the elastic fibers that a lung has. Somebody had a question. Yeah.
You said the atmosphere pressure is 759, and when you breathe out, the pressure in your lungs is 763.
Yeah, something doesn't make sense there. Yeah. I think this is probably 760. Atmospheric pressure should be 760
okay.
millimeters of mercury.
Oh, that makes sense, yeah.
760.
Oh, yeah, it's 760 in the book. I mean, on the slide I have.
Yeah, 760. Should be 760. Because otherwise the air wouldn't flow from low pressure, from high pressure. It wouldn't flow from low pressure to high pressure. Always has to flow from high to low. Okay. All right, so we're always interested in measuring lung volumes in people, and maybe you've had somebody go through surgery, and we're very interested. One of the side effects of surgery is pneumonia, which is an infection of the lungs, for instance. And so what can happen? Fluid can build up inside the lungs, and so we like to get people breathing and expanding their alveoli as much as possible after surgery, get fluid out of there that prevents infection. And so how do you exercise your lungs? By breathing, okay, by breathing deeply. And you might have noticed that they use a little device called a spirometer, and that measures what your inspiratory volume is, and you try to maximize that. And you should probably even practice like every half hour to make sure your lungs are nicely inflated after any kind of surgical parameter. Okay, but we also like to use that spirometer just to measure pulmonary volumes in people to see if they're decreasing or increasing, see if they have asthma or emphysema or other kinds of diseases happening in their lungs. Okay, so we measure pulmonary volumes with a spirometer. And the study of pulmonary volumes is called spirometry. So here is a graph, and this will be an exam figure for you, so you'll have to know these different volumes. Right? All right, so normal lung volume is going to be about 5.7 liters. So you can see that it almost goes up to 6 liters, but not quite. So total lung volume is almost 6 liters. All right, and you can see some small deviations, not from zero, okay, but pretty close to mid-volume, from about 2,500 to almost 3,000 milliliters. And this is what we call tidal volume. So when you're breathing quietly, this is the amount of air that you breathe in and out of your lungs when you're breathing quietly. Okay, we call that tidal volume. All right, but you know, at the end of a normal tidal volume, what can you do? So you can breathe in normally. You can also do what? You can take a really deep breath. You can do what? You can go really inhale as much as possible to a maximal inspiration. So here's a maximal inspiration right here. That volume, that additional volume of air above a normal tidal volume is what we call inspiratory reserve volume. Right, so when you start hyperventilating or force breathing, you can actually ventilate a whole lot more air in and out of your lungs. That's a reserve, right? So inspiratory reserve volume. Furthermore, at the end of a normal tidal volume, what can you do? So if you breathe out normally, before you take another breath, you can forcefully exhale even a lot more air out of your lungs. Right, so that's what we call the expiratory reserve volume. So these are, if we add those three together, inspiratory reserve, tidal volume, and expiratory reserve, that's the amount of air that you can forcefully move in and out of your lungs when you try really, really hard. Like when you're exercising, or maybe singing, or playing a wind instrument or something. Right? And so if we put those three basic volumes together, we get a capacity, which we call vital capacity. Vital capacity is the sum of these three elemental volumes, right? Expiratory, inspiratory reserve, plus tidal volume. So that's what we can forcefully move in and out of our lungs to bring oxygen into our body. Yeah.
So the expiratory reserve is always there if we don't force ourselves to do it?
Yep, it's always there, ready to go to work. If your lungs are normal. If our lungs aren't normal, then guess what happens? As they become more and more abnormal, right, our tidal volume shifts up higher and higher and higher, And it's riding right on the top of our total lung capacity. So that if we change our activity level, what do we run out of? We run out of ventilatory capacity. We can't breathe enough to get oxygen into our bodies. Right? And that's terrible when that happens. Like when somebody has emphysema, for instance, or something like that. And it's usually progressive degenerative disease to where their tidal volume now is bumping right up against their maximal volume. And then sooner or later, right, this volume here, their total lung volume can't be ventilated. Right, but before you get to that point, you'll be put on oxygen, and then you would need a lung transplant, for instance, if that happens. Okay. All right, so there is always some air that's left in our lungs, even a normal lung, that we can't move in and out, no matter how hard we try. And we call that the residual volume. So when somebody has pathology developing in their lung, maybe due to smoking or something, guess what happens to this residual volume? It actually, you know what? It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And what is that doing? That's decreasing inspiratory reserve. It's decreasing expiratory reserve. And if it gets so big that it crowds out tidal volume, well, right, then that would be the end of the story unless you can be placed on oxygen or get a lung transplant. Okay, so that's all what happens. So what do I want you to know for sure? I want you to know tidal volume, expiratory, inspiratory reserve volume, residual volume, the vital capacity composed of these elementary volumes, and then total lung capacity. Okay. If you're at rest, if you have a normal lung, then your tidal volume will be about maybe 500 milliliters. Okay, right smack in the middle of your total lung capacity. All right, so that you have a lot of reserve.
Is this a small wave, what it means at rest?
The small waves are at rest, yeah. That's just normal, quiet breathing. Okay, so what kind of muscles would be you using for this tidal volume? The diaphragm for inspiration, maybe external intercostals. What about for expiration? Passive, completely passive, just the elastic properties of the diaphragm and the external intercostals and the elastic fibers around the alveolus, forcing that air out. Okay. Then for forced breathing, right, then you need to use some of the inspiratory reserve and expiratory reserve, and then you need to recruit some other muscles, okay, like the scalenes, sternocleidomastoid, and then for expiration, to get down into this expiratory reserve, then are all those abdominal muscles, right? So this is kind of a handy graph to look at as a result. Okay, so this is easy points on your next test. Okay, yeah. Functional residual capacity. Well, I'm not going to talk about that, okay? So I'm just going to move on. I'm not going to ask you to label that on the diagram either. Okay, so functional residual capacity, inspiratory capacity, I'm not really going to talk about. Okay, maybe after class. Okay. Okay. Yeah, everything with those two. The two capacities that I want you to know are vital capacity and total lung capacity. Okay. Okay, factors affecting gas exchange. All right, so gas is going to move from high concentration to low concentration, and the way we measure concentration is in the terms of partial pressure. So the pressure that a gas will expend is just going to be the sum of all of the different gases that are in that mixture. So if it's only oxygen, the pressure that's being exerted is just going to be the oxygen pressure. But if there's a mixture of gases, then it's going to be whatever contribution those individual gases are. All right, so for instance, atmospheric pressure pretty much is about 760 millimeters of mercury, and it's composed of nitrogen gas and oxygen and CO2, as well as water vapor, right? And depending on the humidity, that water vapor can change quite a bit. Okay, so in air, the partial pressure of CO2 is 0.3 millimeters of mercury. Oxygen is about 159, but what's the major component of air? It is nitrogen, right? It's exerting a pressure of 601 millimeters of mercury. That totals 760. All right, but when we breathe in, we humidify the air because of our nasal conchae, for instance. All right, so the water partial pressure increases, maybe from zero if it's very dry outside, okay, to 47. Carbon dioxide increases because our body is excreting carbon dioxide. It goes up to about 40 millimeters of mercury, right? And then we absorb oxygen out of that air, so partial pressure of oxygen goes down, right? And nitrogen pretty much stays the same. It doesn't change too much. It's really not any kind of functional gas that we're concerned about, unless maybe you're a scuba diver or something, and you have to be aware of that, because nitrogen does not like to dissolve in body fluids very much, and it can actually pop out, for it can precipitate out and form a bubble, and you don't want to have bubbles in different parts of your body, like your circulatory system or joints. If it's in your circulatory system, it will block blood flow. And if it blocks blood flow to the brain, then it will cause a stroke, or it could block blood flow to the heart and cause a heart attack. Okay, and bubbles can form even in neurons or in nerves or in joints, and that would be very damaging and painful as well. Okay, so we talked about the respiratory membrane. Pulmonary circulation. And I want to talk about matching ventilation to perfusion. All right, so ventilation is air moving in and out of an alveolus. How is it matched to blood flow to a particular alveolus that is being ventilated? Okay, so I want to go back to the last chapter. And here is a blood vessel. All right, so here is a blood vessel. What is one way that we can regulate blood flow through this particular vessel right here? Yes, by constriction or dilation, right? Vasoconstriction, vasodilation. And remember, at the entrance to every capillary, we have a what? The precapillary sphincter. So it's a circular smooth muscle. So a sphincter typically is a circular smooth muscle. And it can constrict or it can relax and dilate. It's going to regulate flow. So what controls the state of constriction of this precapillary sphincter? Okay, so this is what we call local control. Local control, just the metabolic demands of these tissues right here. Okay, so if these tissues aren't very metabolically active, what is high in this area? So if they're quiet, then oxygen is going to be high concentration. Right? When oxygen is a high concentration, these things right here are pretty much constricted because this tissue doesn't need more blood flow. But what happens if they're active, if they're highly metabolic? What happens to oxygen in these tissues right here? It gets used up. Oxygen goes down. What is being produced? CO2. So CO2 does what? It goes the opposite way. CO2 increases, and then something else increases, and that is acids, right? Like maybe lactic acids build up. So what happens to pH?
Down.
Yeah, pH goes down as a result. So all of these things, these metabolites, then can diffuse over to this precapillary sphincter and causes it to relax. All right, and when it relaxes, what happens to blood flow? Blood flow increases, so you get increased perfusion, which is good because it brings in oxygen, it takes away CO2. All right, so we call this local control or metabolic control of this capillary sphincter. This is what happens in the normal systemic circulation. And this is a really good example of what happens in the brain and muscles, local control. Okay, now what about the pulmonary circulation? What's happening in the pulmonary circulation? Now, what can you generally tell me about the pulmonary circulation compared to the systemic circulation?
Shorter.
Shorter. Okay. What about oxygen and CO2? Is it the same in arteries and veins for systemic and pulmonary circulation, or does something change?
It reverses.
It's opposite, right? Because the pulmonary artery is low in oxygen because it's going to the lungs to pick up oxygen. The pulmonary artery is high in CO2 because it's going to the lungs to get rid of it. And it's the pulmonary veins that are opposite systemic veins because pulmonary veins are high in oxygen, low in CO2. So don't forget, blood is going to the lungs to pick up oxygen. All right, so this kind of local control doesn't work very well. In the lungs, it's opposite. So here we have an alveolus, and here we have a capillary around this alveolus. Okay. So when does this capillary sphincter for a capillary alveolus, when does it constrict and when does it dilate? This is interesting. It's going to be the opposite. So this sphincter here dilates when the alveolus is high in oxygen, okay? So that's going to cause dilation, which is the opposite compared to systemic pulmonary circulation. And when it's high in CO2, it's going to cause constriction. Okay, so when it was high in CO2, what did it cause over here? High in CO2, it caused vasodilation, increased blood flow. But when an alveolus is high in CO2, it causes constriction because of the following reason, right? Why would blood want to go to an alveolus if it was high in CO2 or low in oxygen? Why is blood going to this alveolus? To pick up oxygen. If it's low in oxygen and high in CO2, there's no reason for it to go there. As a matter of fact, maybe there's a better place in the lung to go to. And so that's what we call ventilation perfusion matching. It's the opposite. And you should already be kind of aware that the pulmonary and systemic circulations are a little bit different already, right? They're pretty much opposite to each other. And this is kind of interesting because I can relate this a little bit to the lab that you just did. What was the lab you did last week? You did the, I think you did the mean electrical axis of the heart. Okay. Mean electrical axis of the heart, I think. Okay.
We did respiration.
Oh, you did respiration last week. I'm thinking of the mean electrical axis of the heart in particular. Okay. And remember, you calculate the mean electrical axis of the heart because the heart is angulated, but also because the left ventricle has more tissue, so it has more electrical activity, and that puts a little shift, left shift, in the mean electrical axis, but every once in a while somebody's right ventricle hypertrophies and it moves the mean electrical axis to the right. So why does somebody's right ventricle become hypertrophied? Because it's working harder because of pulmonary hypertension. And somebody asked me a couple weeks ago, how do you measure pulmonary hypertension? It's difficult because you don't have any arteries to put a cuff around, right? Well, if somebody has pulmonary hypertension, what could that be caused by? Okay, what happens to pressure when you increase resistance to a blood vessel? The pressure goes up. Okay, when would pressure go up in the pulmonary circulation? And that is when CO2 is high inside the lungs. That's going to cause constriction of these precapillary sphincters. The blood pressure is going to go sky high in the lungs. That's pulmonary hypertension. Okay. When might somebody's alveolar carbon dioxide really increase, causing an increased resistance, increased pressure of the pulmonary circulation, causing pulmonary hypertension? When is somebody's CO2 going way up? When they are hypoventilating, right, when they're not breathing. Typically, when does that occur? For instance, when somebody's asleep. What do we call that when somebody's asleep and stops breathing? That's called sleep apnea, okay? Sleep apnea, they stop breathing, somebody's lungs fill up with carbon dioxide. Because of ventilation perfusion matching, what's the normal mechanism? Blood doesn't need to go to the lungs if there's no oxygen there. The lung resistance increases, causes pulmonary hypertension. And this is all pretty much done without anybody's knowledge, right? And that eventually kills somebody's heart, it kills somebody's lung. So sleep apnea for that reason is really dangerous, right? So if somebody has untreated sleep apnea, they're on their way to getting both a heart and lung transplant. So it's pretty serious. If you know somebody with sleep apnea, it's not something that you should ignore. And one of the easiest ways to tell would be, what, through that mean electrical axis of the heart to see if there's significant hypertrophy of the right side of the heart. That's an easy way to do it. But if you want an echocardiogram or something, you can do that as well. But guess which is more expensive? Okay. Yeah, the echocardiogram. So that's why I think that mean electrical axis of the heart is pretty cool. Okay. All right. So don't forget about that ventilation perfusion matching. And normally, okay, these apical regions of the lung have a really good ventilation perfusion ratio. Down at the base, not quite so good. It's just harder to get air down into these parts of the lung. But just nobody really has problems with ventilation, matching ventilation and perfusion, except in some strange cases, right? Like maybe emphysema, asthma, sleep apnea, things like that. But just remember that it's opposite compared to the systemic circulation because of local control, right? That's metabolic control of the capillaries. All right, so what regulates ventilation? Well, there are centers, the respiratory center in the medulla and the pons. I'm not going to ask you to know much about this right here. Okay, but this is what we call the respiratory center. Some neurons act as pacemakers, some act as inhibitors to the pacemakers to either slow or increase the respiratory rate. All right, but if there are lesions, for instance, in the pons or the medulla, guess what might happen? That's probably an important thing to think about. If there's a lesion, maybe a metabolic lesion or physical lesion due to a stroke or whatever, okay, that's going to disrupt somebody's normal breathing. And there are some people that do have a lesion in the pons, and they can't just relax and automatically breathe like we do. Every time they take a breath, it has to be a conscious breath. They have to physically move their diaphragm and external intercostals to ventilate. All right, so you might wonder, well, how do they sleep? They can't sleep unless they're on a ventilator, right? And that's called Odin's curse when that happens. So that would be tough to live with, that particular kind of malady. All right, so the inspiratory neurons just stimulate the spinal cord motor neurons that innervate the respiratory muscles like what? Diaphragm, external intercostals. Expiration is passive, and that happens when the inspiratory muscles are inhibited or relaxed, like the diaphragm, for instance. Okay, I don't think I'm going to ask you anything about this, but this is important here. Okay, so how do you activate the respiratory center? Well, there are chemoreceptors, and there are two locations for chemoreceptors. So for controlling ventilation, what do you think would be a good kind of molecule for your body to keep track of all the time? One I'd like is, in my impression, but it's the wrong one to pick on, and that is, I always thought it was oxygen, okay, because your body needs oxygen. But that's not the most important one. The most important one is CO2. It is by far the most important chemical stimulator for ventilation, okay? So there, the two places for chemoreceptors that control ventilation are central receptors in the medulla oblongata, right, in the respiratory center, and there are peripheral chemoreceptors in the carotid bodies in the carotid sinus, right? The carotid sinus is right at the bifurcation of the internal and external carotid with the common carotid. There's a little bulge right there. And then the aortic bodies in the arch of the aorta. These are the peripheral receptors. The central receptors are very sensitive to pH and carbon dioxide. Now, why is pH and carbon dioxide almost the same variable? How would you describe to somebody that If you were to monitor pH of something or measure pH, that's just as good as measuring the carbon dioxide of something in biological tissue. They're directly related to each other because of a particular enzyme. What's the name of that enzyme? Okay. What should I erase? I guess I'll erase this thing right here. Okay. We've got CO2. All right. And then CO2, and this is a two-way street. CO2, I think, plus H2O can form H2CO3, which is carbonic acid. Right, and then carbonic acid can break down to hydrogen ion plus HCO. Sorry, I'm kind of falling off the board. Bicarbonate, right? Okay, so when your body produces CO2, it's producing hydrogen ions. And anybody know that enzyme that makes that happen? You did have to know that for one of these tests. That is what? Carbonic anhydrase. Does that? Okay, so so measuring pH, right? So as pH goes down, CO2 goes up because of Le Chatelier's principle. Right? So knowing one, you pretty much know the other. The central receptors are very sensitive to small changes in CO2 or small changes in pH. That will, so if CO2 increases, if pH goes down, that's going to stimulate ventilation. Very powerful drive for ventilation, not necessarily oxygen. The aortic bodies over here are sensitive to oxygen and not so much CO2, but not in the physiologic range. Right? They hardly influence ventilation at all when oxygen concentration changes in our bodies. It's only when we become very hypoxic. And when I say hypoxic, I mean when our oxygen concentration drops drastically. So the aortic bodies only work under conditions of like when you're choking and or not breathing, right? It's the central receptors that are doing most of the work for us. Okay. 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 So I think I talked about this already. All right. So chemoreceptors, the central chemoreceptors, modify ventilation to maintain normal CO2 and pH levels, and then oxygen concentration pretty much just goes along for the ride. Okay. Okay, so decreased ventilation will increase arterial PCO2, that's the concentration of CO2 in our body. Then what happens to pH? pH decreases because of the carbonic anhydrase reaction. All right, chemoreceptors in the aorta and carotid bodies influence the respiratory signal to stimulate respiratory muscles. All right, but even more importantly is that increased arterial PCO2 increases plasma carbon dioxide. All right, and that's in the blood. That decreases the pH of the interstitial fluid in the blood because carbon dioxide is related to pH by the carbonic anhydrase reaction. Chemoreceptors in the medulla oblongata powerfully stimulate the respiratory center to increase ventilation. And you can see that this response subtracts from the initial stimulus, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so brain chemoreceptors are responsible for the greatest effects on ventilation. Hydrogen ions, because they're charged particles, can't diffuse across the blood-brain barrier. Right, so hydrogen ions can't really get from the blood into the chemoreceptors of the medulla oblongata, but CO2 can. All right, so that's why CO2 is monitored in these central receptors. All right, so the rate and depth of ventilation is adjusted to maintain a PCO2 of about 40 millimeters of mercury. And if it goes higher than that, that's going to stimulate respirations. If it's lower, it's going to inhibit respirations. And these peripheral chemoreceptors in the carotid bodies and the aortic bodies, those don't really regulate. They don't respond to CO2 levels. Okay, so here is a diagram that shows you CO2 in plasma. It moves across the blood-brain barrier, and then it's in CO2 is in the cerebrospinal fluid, and then because of carbonic anhydrase, that makes carbonic acid, and that acidity then triggers the chemoreceptors, neurons in the medulla oblongata. So it's not CO2, I mean, it's not hydrogen ions directly in the blood, right? It is CO2 in the blood that causes a decrease of hydrogen ion in the medulla oblongata. Okay. So what I've been talking about can be demonstrated on this slide right here. So here we see a slide, okay, a plot of ventilation versus concentration of oxygen, and also plotted against concentration percent of CO2. Right? And CO2 is this dark line. Does it have a color? Red? Okay. All right, so when CO2 is buried, that's the red line. When oxygen concentration is buried, that's the blue line right here. Okay. All right, so notice that a big difference in scale is from 1 to 10% for CO2, and then it's 18, okay, to 0% for oxygen over here. So oxygen is plotted in the reverse sense because we want to look at how the respiratory system is stimulated. Right? So as oxygen concentration goes down, that should mean what? That stimulates the respiratory center. CO2 is the opposite way, because as CO2 goes up, that should stimulate the respiratory center. But these are pretty much justified to each other. So the red line, okay, which line deviates first as we're moving from left to right? You see? Carbon dioxide. That just signifies that carbon dioxide is a more powerful stimulator of ventilation than oxygen is. Notice, look at oxygen. Pretty much a flat line until you get to almost, right, as you approach 0%, then it becomes a significant drive for ventilation. All right, so this just shows that carbon dioxide is the more powerful stimulus. An increase in carbon dioxide is more powerful in stimulating ventilation than a decrease in oxygen. That's what this slide shows. Okay. There's one reflex. So the lung tissue is kind of delicate, right? There's elastic tissue around the alveoli that prevent overstretching. But a lung can be overinflated. It can be overstretched. So there is a reflex that protects our body from that. It's called the Herring-Brewer reflex. So it's mediated by stretch receptors that are activated during inspiration. And as we inhale, these receptors send more and more action potentials to the brain, and they inhibit inspiration to prevent overinflation of the lungs. And so we call that the Herring-Brewer reflex, right, for preventing overinflation. I think you have a little bit of a question or two of that in the end of chapter questions, right? Herring-Brewer reflex prevents overinflation of the lungs. All right, so let's talk about how these gases are transported by the blood. And the things that we're most interested in, of course, are carbon dioxide and oxygen. Carbon dioxide can dissolve in fluid pretty, very, very nicely. All right, so a lot of carbon dioxide is just transported as carbon dioxide in the blood, just dissolved in the blood. But oxygen dissolves very poorly. Oh yeah, where's that sign-in sheet? Who's got the sign-in sheet? Oh, it's down here. Great. Anybody need the sign-in sheet? Okay. Pass it around again one more time. Okay. So oxygen doesn't like to dissolve in fluid, so there has to be a special carrier for oxygen. And guess what that carrier is? It's a molecule called hemoglobin. Okay. And red blood cells are loaded with hemoglobin. I forget how many molecules. 800 million molecules of hemoglobin in every red blood cell. It's millions, okay? And so that's the job of a red blood cell, and its only job. As a matter of fact, a red blood cell doesn't have any organelles. There's no room for anything else inside of it except for hemoglobin, okay? So loading of hemoglobin with oxygen occurs in the lungs, unloading occurs in the tissues, right? So hemoglobin has an affinity for oxygen, And it changes with a number of variables that we're going to look at. But I want to show you what hemoglobin looks like. Here is heme. And hemoglobin has four of these heme elements in it. So every hemoglobin can carry four oxygen molecules, right? Which drastically increases the amount of oxygen that can be carried by the blood. This is how we think of it. Let's take some plasma right here and bubble oxygen through it. And we'll saturate plasma, and this doesn't have any red blood cells, that will completely saturate plasma, and we can get to 3 milliliters of oxygen per 100 milliliters of blood if there are no red blood cells with hemoglobin. Right, so some oxygen will dissolve in blood, but not very much. All right, but now let's put hemoglobin. Let's put whole blood. Right, with red blood cells, and for every hemoglobin, how many oxygens can be carried? You can see on this diagram, 4. And now if we measure how much oxygen can be carried, when oxygen binds to hemoglobin, we call that oxyhemoglobin. Now we can put 20 milliliters of oxygen in blood fluid per 100 milliliters of blood. So I can carry a tremendous amount of oxygen as a result of this hemoglobin right here. Okay, binding to the hemoglobin. All right, so what was I going to say about this? All right, so your blood needs hemoglobin to transport oxygen. How does it transport oxygen? All right, I'm going to have to go to another slide to show you this. Which is right here. Okay, so here is a graph that shows percent oxyhemoglobin saturation. So what do we mean? Oxyhemoglobin is hemoglobin that has bound oxygen, that's transporting oxygen, versus the partial pressure of oxygen. Right? It shows this sigmoidal kind of curve. Right? So as the PO2 increases, what happens to the percent of saturation of hemoglobin? It increases, right? So they're directly related to each other. All right, so in the arteries, right, in the systemic circulation, we have almost 100% saturation of hemoglobin. All right, so in arteries, at least systemic arteries, all right, we have 100 millimeters of mercury of oxygen, okay, and at that partial pressure, we have 100% saturation of hemoglobin. So it's fully loaded. Now you might wonder, well, how is it that oxygen can be delivered to tissues if it's stuck to hemoglobin? Okay. How does hemoglobin know to release oxygen to the tissues? Well, if you look at the tissues, right, so in the tissues, what's happening to oxygen around the tissues? It decreases, right? So the partial pressure of oxygen in the tissues, and as a matter of fact in veins, right, is 40 millimeters of mercury. So what does that mean? That means that oxygen is going to dissociate from hemoglobin as defined by this oxygen saturation curve right here, just because, again, you could think of Le Chatelier's principle. As your body utilizes oxygen, it's going to pull oxygen off of hemoglobin molecules, and actually how much of it can change. Right, so it's going to change from 20 milliliters of oxygen per 100 milliliters of blood to 15. So this is the amount of oxygen that can be released from hemoglobin when it goes from the arterial end of a capillary to the venous end of the capillary. So not all of the oxygen is going to be released from hemoglobin, but enough to, right, power oxidative phosphorylation in the tissues. Right, so the binding of oxygen is determined by just the partial pressure of oxygen in the blood. And that can change via a couple of circumstances. All right, so here are three oxygen binding curves of PO2 and oxyhemoglobin. as it changes with pH. All right, so what happens, for instance, with exercise? What happens to the pH during exercise, and what can you tell me about oxygen? You need more oxygen or less oxygen in the tissues when you exercise? You need more. So you start to exercise muscle, produce lactic acid. So what happens to pH? It actually goes down as a result of that. Let's look what happens to the binding curve for oxyhemoglobin. All right, so in the lungs, our pH is about 7.4, so this is the normal binding curve for oxygen. And in an exercising tissue, you see that the pH goes down, but look at the oxygen binding curve. It gets shifted to the right. All right, so now we said that in tissues, the PO2 goes down to about 40. Where would be 40? 10, 20, I guess maybe, oh here, 20, 30, 40. All right, with, and in arterial blood, what's the saturation of hemoglobin in arterial blood? It's going to be 100% basically, okay? In non-exercising tissue, what would be the unloading? It's going to go down here to now 75% saturated, but in an exercising tissue, what's the pH? It's a lot lower. All right, so now what's the oxygen binding capacity of hemoglobin at this lower pH? It drops down to 60. All right, so you see this big increase of unloading of oxygen just because of the pH change and its relationship on binding of oxygen to hemoglobin. So as pH decreases, this oxygen binding curve shifts to the right, and that just unloads more oxygen into the tissues. And is that beneficial? Well, yeah, because the tissue is exercising. So this binding curve shifts depending on pH, okay? But it also shifts to the right, like this. For instance, when there's a change in temperature. As the temperature increases, there's a right shift as well. And what happens to muscle, the temperature of muscle, when it's exercising? It warms up, okay? So as the tissue warms up, the binding curve shifts to the right, and that also increases the amount of oxygen delivery to the tissues as well. Okay. So it shifts to the right as a result of both of these particular conditions, both with pH and temperature. Okay. All right, now as far as carbon dioxide transport in the blood, okay, and then I guess we'll finish up. Carbon dioxide transport in the blood, we've got CO2 produced by tissues. It dissolves quite easily into plasma, right? 10% is always going to be found in plasma. You won't even find 1% of oxygen dissolved in the blood. All right, so CO2 dissolves into plasma, and then it can dissolve into this red blood cell right here. And you have carbonic anhydrase in this red blood cell, so it's going to convert CO2 into bicarbonate. And I don't know what the saturation level of bicarbonate is in body fluids, but it's tremendous, right? You could take a box of baking soda, which is basically bicarbonate, put it in a cup of water, and it pretty much all dissolves, right? So for physiologic reasons, there's almost no limit to how much carbon dioxide we can dissolve in our body because of the carbonic anhydrase reaction. So as tissues produce CO2, red blood cells convert it into bicarbonate, and CO2 then is converted or transported to the lungs as bicarbonate, not as CO2. All right, so then that bicarbonate dissolves into the plasma. That's an anion. So in order to maintain the electrical neutrality of this red blood cell, chloride ions have to diffuse in. So we call this the chloride shift that, right, transports carbon dioxide in the blood. All right, so this is in the tissues. Now what happens when you get to the lungs? Ooh, do I have it in the lungs right here? Okay. Well, you can probably picture this. So the air in the alveolus, what's the concentration of air inside that alveolus, or concentration of CO2? It's very low. So CO2 will dissolve out of plasma into the alveolar air. All right, but don't forget that carbonic anhydrase reaction has almost no delta G associated with it, so it's freely reversible, right? So because of Le Chatelier's principle then, bicarbonate that's in the plasma will dissolve into the red blood cell. It will combine with hydrogen ions. Chloride will leak out. That produces carbonic acid, and that carbonic acid will dissociate into carbon dioxide. Right, because carbon dioxide is lowering inside the plasma, carbon dioxide will leave the red blood cell into the plasma, then furthermore into the alveolus. Right, so then bicarbonate, the bottom line, bicarbonate is then converted back into CO2, which then we exhale. Right, so oxygen isn't converted into an alternate form for transport, it is bound to hemoglobin. Carbon dioxide is converted into an alternate form, namely bicarbonate, and that's transported in the blood. And that's how we exhale carbon dioxide when bicarbonate is converted back into CO2 in the lungs. Okay. All right, so I think that's kind of the last slide, except I got a couple more comments to make. Okay. Let's go back to hemoglobin. Not only can hemoglobin bind oxygen, all right, it binds a little bit of CO2, not very much. And when it binds CO2, that bumps off oxygen. But there's another compound that binds very effectively with hemoglobin. And when it does, we call it carboxyhemoglobin as opposed to oxyhemoglobin. And that molecule is carbon monoxide. What does carbon monoxide look like? What's the formula? It is just CO. Right, and what's the chemical that your body produces? Make sure you don't get that confused. You produce what? CO2. Big difference. Right? CO2 doesn't bind hemoglobin, but carbon monoxide does. And when carbon monoxide binds to hemoglobin, it excludes oxygen. Right? So what happens to the oxygen carrying capacity of blood when there's carbon monoxide in the blood? It goes way down because there's almost no oxygen dissolved in plasma. It has to be carried by hemoglobin. And carbon monoxide will bind to hemoglobin 210 times more strongly. All right, so very small amounts of carbon monoxide can completely bind up all of the hemoglobin and prevent transport of oxygen. All right, so let's draw a hemoglobin. So here's a hemoglobin. Here's a hemoglobin, and it's bound to a carbon monoxide. It's excluding oxygen, right? We can bump that carbon monoxide off of there, but how much oxygen do we have to put into this system to get this CO2 molecule off? All right, so this is the antidote for somebody that has carbon monoxide poisoning. We have to give them oxygen. How much oxygen do we have to give them? How many molecules do I have to draw here to get that one off to have an equal chance of being, just an equal chance? I have to draw 210 of these oxygen molecules to get that one carbon monoxide off. All right, so that kind of shows you how dangerous carbon monoxide poisoning is, you know, and also how we treat it. But what is the source for carbon monoxide? Okay. Any kind of burning of an organic fuel, like burning candles, burning wax, burning gasoline, for instance, burning propane in your barbecue or burning charcoal briquettes in your barbecue, you know, any of that kind of stuff is going to produce carbon monoxide. Or turning your heater on in your house, your furnace, if it's a gas furnace that produces CO2, or a fireplace, for instance, and all that, carbon monoxide should be exhausted from your residence. Okay, it doesn't happen too much in the springtime, but in the fall when people's furnaces are misbehaving, in the United States there's probably at least 10 families throughout the United States that get wiped out because they go to sleep at night and something malfunctions, the flue isn't clear, and the house fills up with carbon monoxide, and carbon monoxide is odorless. You can't sense it, and you really can't tell that anything is bad happening to you. You just fall asleep. And as a result, you don't wake up. So, sometimes you have a headache. So if you're awake, you realize you have a headache, but who's normally going to relate a headache to carbon monoxide poisoning, right? Unless you're educated. But if you're asleep, you don't even notice that you have a headache. That can happen to people, for instance, if you're out camping and it's really cold out and you have your tent all closed up and you bring maybe a barbecue in to heat your tent, or a lot of candles or something, and you leave the candles burning when you're sleeping, right? That has drastic consequences as well. And even people, you know, that live in New York City or Boston, Chicago, where it gets really cold in the wintertime, they might bring a barbecue in to help warm up their house if they can't pay electric bills or heating bills, right? And these things are usually fatal as a result of that. So you got to be careful of that carbon monoxide.
Is it painless then?
And it's painless, yeah. You just don't notice anything bad. You might have an experience of a headache and maybe a little incoordination or something like that, but that's the only sign that you have carbon monoxide poisoning. And it takes very little amounts of carbon monoxide, because once it binds to hemoglobin, it doesn't let go. So a little bit over a long period of time is just as dangerous as a moderate level for a short period of time. Oh, they make really nice alarms these days for carbon monoxide. But they last maybe 3 years or so. And they're expensive. But it's really it's a serious consideration. Yeah.